The enemy still wants to strike us.
Terrorism, war, disaster, and disease are grim realities brought to our doorstep in our increasingly connected world. And these realities ultimately shape America's national security and foreign policies.
We've become a nervous country. We spend more on our national defense and security than any other nation in the world, and we don't feel safe as Americans.
What role should America play in 21st century global security? Can the United States be a positive role model? Will other nations follow?
We cannot dry up the sources of terrorism on our own.
Sometimes you have to act and then hope that public opinion will follow.
I'm David Brancaccio. Join me this hour for Beyond Fear, America's Role in an Uncertain World, from the Stanley Foundation and KQED Public Radio.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
More after this. I'm David Brancaccio, and this is Beyond Fear, America's Role in an Uncertain World, from the Stanley Foundation and KQED Public Radio.
Los Angeles turns out in force to scream a welcome to two of the war's outstanding heroes, General Blood and Guts Patton and General Jimmy Doolittle.
These old newsreels, once commonplace in movie theaters, presented a black and white world of good and evil. America was always the hero. Today, our world is a murkier place. Terrorism, war, disaster, and disease are grim realities brought to our doorstep in our increasingly connected world.
The enemy still wants to strike us. The enemy still wants to achieve safe haven from which to plot and plan. The enemy would like to have weapons of mass destruction in order to attack us. These are lethal, cold-blooded killers.
And as President Bush frequently asserts, these realities have to shape America's national security and foreign policies.
Right now, there's a premium more on things that build fear or exploit the fear that Americans have about their basic security.
Steve Clemens is the director of the American Strategy Program at the New America Foundation in Washington.
We've become a nervous country. We spend more on our national defense and security than any other nation in the world, and we don't feel safe as Americans.
But fear itself cannot drive our daily lives. We know weapons, disease, drugs, and other security threats move more freely around the world than ever before. If national borders can't contain these threats, how do we stop them? What role should the United States play in this effort? And will other nations play along?
The spike in anti-Americanism is troubling. It's not that we have to run a popularity contest, but when the world doesn't trust us, it's very difficult to get them to follow us.
Ambassador Nancy Soderbergh is a former Clinton administration national security official. When the U.S. plays what she sees as a positive leadership role, the world usually follows, as was the case when the war in Afghanistan won overwhelming global support. But the Iraq conflict has tarnished America's global image. Soderbergh believes rebuilding global trust in the United States will lead not only to better foreign relations, but will ultimately strengthen the security within our own borders.
Unfortunately, the threats are global and the solutions are global. We cannot dry up the sources of terrorism on our own. We cannot keep weapons of mass destruction out of the hands of terrorists on our own. We need to engage the global community, and that means leading it.
America plays host to a group.
Following the collapse of the Soviet Empire, the United States has remained the world's lone superpower. Does this mean we have to be in the driver's seat for solving every global problem? Vintage newsreels show America was once recognized as the leader in times of crisis.
We shall send you in ever-increasing numbers ships, planes, tanks, guns. That is our purpose and our pledge.
America became the arsenal of democracy.
Another Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, is the author of the legendary "Speak softly but carry a big stick" line about America's posture in the world. In many cases, that big stick is the massive U.S. military, 737 bases around the world, and an imposing $462 billion annual budget. The United States military is beginning to use some of its vast resources to play the speak softly role by carrying out work normally reserved for diplomats and humanitarians. But is this the right role for the U.S. military? Correspondent Kristen McHugh traveled to the Horn of Africa, a key crossroads between Africa and the Middle East, to investigate the Pentagon's latest efforts to promote a positive view of America's leadership far from home.
This fresh, clean water is flowing in a remote African village thanks to the U.S. military.
From a civil engineer's perspective, this is a great operation for us because I like the humanitarian aspect of it. The good news is we haven't done any fighting, and we hope to keep it that way.
Commander Paul Vandenberg is part of the Seabees, the U.S. Navy's engineering corps. Today, he is based at Camp Lemene in the tiny African nation of Djibouti, headquarters of the Combined Joint Task Force Horn of Africa.
The work that our troops are doing, building schools and repairing schools and drilling water wells in some very drought areas, you know, it really gives you a good feeling. And ultimately, that's the way I think we're going to really change this part of the world.
Show you what you're looking at. To the north, obviously, the airport. Sometimes we've got to park our bigger airplanes over there. That's one of our C-17s, as you can see. To the west, hillside, town of Bulbala.
The U.S. Central Command has operated the Combined Joint Task Force Horn of Africa, also known as CJTF-HOA, since 2002. Its stated mission is, quote, to prevent conflict, promote regional stability, and protect coalition interests in East Africa and Yemen through humanitarian assistance. Stationed at America's largest military base in Africa, troops here come from nearly a dozen different countries and all branches of the U.S. military, including the U.S. Coast Guard. Task force members are building health clinics, providing medical and veterinary care, renovating schools like this one in Tajora, Djibouti, and providing fresh water sources.
What we're doing is getting a grid on the well, is to making sure we know exactly where it is on the grid.
The Army National Guard's 1132nd well digging crew from Mooresville, North Carolina, believes this work is fully part of the global war on terror. Today, the crew is surveying a water well for rehabilitation, a well located along an ancient camel trail in the middle of a desert oasis.
East 041 degrees.
What we're doing here, we're actually doing more of a preemptive strike.
This is the group's acting first sergeant, William Robert Brown.
The terrorist organizations go into countries like this, and they'll go in and promise these people money so that they can use their children or their younger men and younger women to do terrorist acts.
When we left Djibouti, we came down through Dakhil, and we passed Yuboki, and then right here is where we took a left turn at the tires on the hill and went out into the desert.
Just by virtue of being here and training these militaries in the Horn of Africa, we see a limited presence of terrorist threats, insurgents. Because we're here, they are not here. So indirectly, yes, America is a safer place by virtue of us being here and the insurgents not.
U.S. Army Major John Hill is in charge of America's military-to-military training across the Horn of Africa. Eastern Africa has long been considered a breeding ground for terrorists and terror activities. The FBI first placed Osama bin Laden on its top 10 most wanted list after the 1998 U.S. embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania.
Next section.
Major Hill has served in Iraq and plans to return. He and his men at the Combined Joint Task Force trained the Ethiopian troops which recently attacked extremist groups in Somalia. But he is quick to add that America's efforts to undermine terrorist organizations in the Horn of Africa go far beyond military strikes. Major Hill says what they're doing in Djibouti represents the future of the U.S. military.
We are still waging war. I feel this is a different mission. It's a great mission. It's unlike any other you'll see. This really is the forefront of where we should be in the future in Iraq and Afghanistan.
There are skeptics. Some worry this focus on so-called soft security issues like schools and water wells will distract from the military's primary fighting mission. Others say the military is ill-suited for long-term development projects. They say civilian services are best delivered by civilians, that using the military for these projects is confusing to the people being served, and that the money and resources would be better spent by the Peace Corps, the State Department, or the United Nations. But even America's diplomatic representatives in Djibouti are eager to give proper credit to the military's role in the region.
The military has always had a civil affairs unit. And rather than have them roaming around the country nilly-willy, They're helping build health centers. They're helping build schools.
Janet Shulman is the country director for the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, in Djibouti. Today, she is inspecting a rural health clinic built with USAID assistance.
They're giving hope to children who otherwise may never have hope and may be stuck in certain religious schools that will train them to become fanatics.
This passes for downtown right here. You got the store, basketball courts over there.
Back at Camp Lemonnier, the sense that these troops are on a new kind of mission seems to have sunk deep into the camp culture. Troops are even volunteering their spare time to help locals better their lives and to improve Djiboutian perceptions of America.
These kids, they don't know what a family life really is like, so we try and provide that by being the bigger brother or the bigger sister.
Navy RP3 Nathaniel Young of Guam is part of Camp Lemonnier's Chaplain Corps. He previously served on board the USS Comstock in the Iraq War. The camp's Chaplain Corps has adopted two local orphanages and raised thousands of dollars to renovate dilapidated buildings. Every week, vanloads of American troops arrive to play basketball and soccer with these boys.
If you're given an opportunity to stay at base or go do something that matters and gives meaning to your day, why not go and do something that means something?
Since the attacks in Iraq, the people here had a negative image of Americans. But since their arrival, we have seen the good side of Americans.
Wandering around Djibouti City's downtown and sprawling marketplace, we found Kennedy Mohammed Ali, a journalist from Djibouti's government-owned newspaper, The Nation.
Since the American forces arrived in Djibouti, there has been a lot of progress. Progress on the level of national education, because they have contributed to the construction of schools. Progress in terms of roads, since they've rehabilitated the roads. I can sincerely say that the American president has brought considerable progress to Djibouti.
For all the good being done here by the Horn of Africa Task Force, there are only 1,700 troops in Djibouti, and the estimated $49 million it will cost to run the task force in 2007 is a tiny drop in the Defense Department's $462 billion budget. But the scope of this effort may be about to change.
We have started to work towards establishing Africa Command.
Currently, the Pentagon divides responsibility for Africa operations among what they call Central Command, European Command, and Pacific Command. But an all-new Africa Command, also known as AFRICOM, was announced earlier this year as a way of uniting and integrating U.S. military operations across the continent. Admiral Tim Moon is deputy commander of the Horn of Africa Task Force.
Hopefully they can take the lessons learned from everybody who's operated on the continent and come together with a truly dynamic organization that's able to meet the many unique requirements that you find in a landmass this big.
This is certainly the best view you're going to get all day.
AFRICOM won't be fully operational until next year. In the meantime, Camp Lemonnier is expanding.
The actual camp's going to keep expanding almost to the water.
The base commander, U.S. Navy Captain Bob Fahey, thinks this is a very good thing.
I've been to a lot of interesting places. You know, I've been to Bosnia, Desert Storm, Haiti. This is without question the most rewarding thing I've ever done in the military. I had several people tell me, hey, I wanted to come here. I wanted to come to Africa, you know, make a difference. So that's very rewarding for everyone.
For Beyond Fear, I'm Kristen McHugh in Djibouti.
I'm not sure that this is the best use of our military. I think the best use of our military is to make places secure.
Ken Bacon was the official Pentagon spokesman from 1994 through 2001 and now serves as the president of Refugees International, a Washington-based nonprofit that provides humanitarian assistance to people displaced by conflict or natural disasters around the world. He believes existing non-governmental organizations, or NGOs, are better suited than the U.S. military to provide humanitarian assistance.
If the U.S. believes that more wells need to be drilled in Djibouti, they can hire Oxfam, they can hire all sorts of NGOs to drill the wells. and they will do it, I guarantee you, for much less money than it will cost the U.S. military to do it.
The worry is the U.S. sends a confusingly mixed message when the military delivers humanitarian aid.
On a day-to-day basis, I don't think it makes sense to have soldiers with uniforms carrying arms, perhaps driving around in armed Humvees delivering military aid, because it tends to confuse, in the eyes of the people receiving this, confuses humanitarian work with military protection.
I literally thought I was in the Twilight Zone in my visits to the U.S. Force Camp Le Meunier, because I was getting these wonderful briefings from very well-meaning U.S. military personnel who believed very strongly in the whole idea of building good, solid relations with communities as a means of getting their support for our longer-term counterterrorism interests.
John Prendergast is senior advisor to the International Crisis Group. This one is an NGO with the stated aim of preventing conflict worldwide. Like Ken Bacon, he's got a problem with that work the military is doing in the Horn of Africa, but from a different angle.
But at the same time we were doing all this wonderful stuff for the last 2.5 years in the region, we were also providing, through our CIA station chief in Kenya, suitcases full of cash to warlords.
You're listening to Beyond Fear, America's Role in an Uncertain World, from the Stanley Foundation and KQED Public Radio. On the web at stanleyfoundation.org and kqed.org. Coming up, if America doesn't want Iran and North Korea to develop nuclear programs, why is it giving India a green light? And later, a talk with former Secretary of State Colin Powell.
We're a rich nation, and we can afford whatever we need if we're willing to pay for it.
I'm David Brancaccio. More after this. I'm David Brancaccio, and this is Beyond Fear, America's Role in an Uncertain World, from the Stanley Foundation and KQED Public Radio.
The lethal A-bomb is wheeled, carefully screened, toward the B-29 that is to carry it to Bikini. Once again, we see the destructive power of atomic energy. Up, up, 7 miles into the sky, the awe-inspiring cloud billows and surges, blotting out the destruction
below. In 1946, the newsreel version of the world was still captivated by what one of the little films called the awe-inspiring cloud from atomic weapons. By 1950, though, with nuclear know-how spreading to other countries, some were trying to put the genie back in the bottle.
Mr. Truman dramatically calls on the World Assembly of Nations to bring about real disarmament through control of atomic and all other weapons.
The spread of nuclear weapons around the world, the Three Mile Island nuclear accident, and the vexing question on what to do with nasty spent radioactive fuel gave the atom a bad name. Then, 21 years ago, this.
The Soviet Union has admitted that an accident has taken place at a nuclear power station at Chernobyl in the Ukraine. But as usual when disasters occur, the Soviet authorities have released very little information.
Even before news anchors learned to pronounce the word Chernobyl, it was apparent that the Ukrainian city could become the site of the worst nuclear accident the world had ever seen. Back in April 1986, of course, no one was predicting that the Soviet Union would, within 5.5 years, fall apart. When it did, the U.S. moved quickly to help safeguard nuclear materials on Ukrainian soil, an effort given even more urgency by the disarray surrounding the Soviet nuclear programs that was revealed by the disaster at Chernobyl. Even now, in 2007, efforts are still underway to ensure that the enormous stockpile of old Soviet nuclear materials does not fall into the hands of terrorists. But elsewhere in the world, the Bush administration has been seeking to expand the abilities of some U.S. allies to operate in the nuclear sphere, not contain them. Correspondent Simon Marks begins our report in India, 600 feet below ground.
It doesn't take long to get from the surface of the Jadugura uranium mine in India to the rock face itself. A short elevator ride, lasting no more than a minute, plunges miners from the bright sunshine in this picturesque region, 900 miles southeast of Delhi, to a cavernous labyrinth of enormous tunnels dug out of the lightly coloured rock. The miners here work in two 12-hour shifts, drilling deep to mine 2,500 tons of rock each day. It isn't like a coal mine. You can't actually see the uranium. Radiation tests tell the mining engineers where to drill. They then gather the rock, which is delivered into an enormous grinder. The rocks tumble down a chute where the process of pulverizing them begins. It is from this powdered rock that the uranium will eventually be derived, much of it in the form of yellow cake, to fuel India's civil and military nuclear programs. The Indians have been mining it at Jadugura for a long time.
From 1968 onwards, we are producing uranium here. So it's not a new endeavor at all.
Ramendra Gupta heads the Uranium Corporation of India. India's rapid population growth and economic rise has left the country in desperate need of energy. Currently, only 3% of India's power is supplied by the nuclear industry. Mr. Gupta wants to see that figure rise sevenfold.
If we want to sustain 8% growth, we need more power. And to have enough power, nuclear power is a good alternative. Most of the fossil fuel which is being imported, it is coming from areas which are politically not very stable.
Thanks for coming. Welcome to the White House.
That is an argument the Bush administration buys, and the president himself has enthusiastically proposed a new deal between Washington and New Delhi that will permit India to expand its civil nuclear program to meet its energy needs.
India is now the world's fifth largest consumer of energy, and its demand for electricity is expected to double by 2015. The United States has a clear interest in helping India meet this demand with nuclear energy.
The pride of India's nuclear industry can be found just outside Mumbai, the commercial capital in the south of the country that used to be called Bombay. The Tarapur Atomic Power Project is the largest nuclear reactor site in the country. There are two pressurized heavy water reactors here, vast bulbous structures that buzz with the kind of quiet hum associated with the world's most modern nuclear facilities.
If you look at the democratic fiber in India, I think it's very strong.
Anil Kakodkar is the chairman of India's Atomic Energy Commission, the highest-ranking nuclear official in the country. He oversees the industry, including the Tarapur site. He's a firm believer that as the world's largest democracy, India not only needs a nuclear program, but can be trusted with one as well.
India has always behaved in a responsible manner. Just look at India's non-proliferation record. You'll find our record is impeccable. In fact, I would not hesitate saying that India's track record is better than some of the, shall I say, NPT weapon states.
That reference to the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, of which India is not a signatory, goes to the very heart of the concerns expressed by critics about the proposed US-India deal. India is one of only four countries not to honour the treaty. Pakistan, Israel and North Korea are the other three. Despite that, the proposed agreement with Washington will give India a chance to enjoy many of the benefits previously reserved for countries that have signed the treaty. Worse still, say the critics, India will be allowed to continue developing its military nuclear program.
At 1545 hours on 11th May 1998, Three devices were detonated simultaneously, a variety of sophisticated instruments.
Its decision to continue testing nuclear weapons, an event heralded at the time by proud coverage on Indian television, was roundly condemned by the US and its allies. No country that has signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty has been permitted to cooperate with India's nuclear program, nor has India been allowed to import supplies of uranium. But the deal with Washington will change all that.
I don't think India could ever have had it so good.
Professor P.R. Chari with the Institute of Peace and Conflict Studies in New Delhi argues that the proposed deal with Washington, which is still under negotiation and subject to congressional approval, would lift virtually all the sanctions India has faced without seeking any of the Non-Proliferation Treaty's commitments in return.
This particular Indo-US nuclear deal, it really drives a horse and carriage through the Non-Proliferation Treaty. It makes it meaningless. Any other country, especially the 180 or so that have signed, could very well ask their own question that why don't we also go ahead and explode a nuclear device? If an exception can be made for India, why not for us?
Because, say Indian officials, they're at the helm of a burgeoning democracy that is poised to become a regional economic superpower. And at the uranium mine in Jadagura, we witnessed heavy security as the fences and gates surrounding the facility were put under lock and key at the end of the workday. Heavily armed Indian soldiers guard the mine around the clock, and Ramendra Gupta, head of the Uranium Corporation of India, says he is certain there is no risk that India's nuclear materials could ever fall into the hands of terrorists.
I am very sure we have the necessary security safeguards in place. So I am very sure none of these things are going to happen.
The Bush administration's decision to offer India a deal represents at the very least a shift in non-proliferation strategy. In other parts of the world, the US previously sought to eradicate nuclear weapons and safeguard nuclear materials designed for peaceful purposes. 3,000 miles from Delhi, in the Ukrainian capital Kiev, you can find evidence of that approach by visiting the Paton Electric Welding Institute. The engineers here work with enormous welding tanks guiding robots that are capable of creating some of the strongest seals between two pieces of metal that science has yet designed.
There's a very large vacuum chamber. It's the size of a tank. And there's a reason why it's the size of a tank.
U.S. State Department contractor Victor Corson is the deputy executive director of the Science and Technology Center of Ukraine. Jointly funded by the U.S., the European Union and Canada, it oversees the conversion of plants like the Paton Institute that were originally built to serve the Soviet military and are now finding commercial customers for their services.
It is to change swords into plowshares is certainly a good way to put it. The mission here is to work with former weapons scientists to redirect their skills into peaceful applications.
It wasn't only the fate of Soviet scientists that worried Western governments when the USSR collapsed. Nuclear warheads themselves were dismantled. Enormous chainsaws were taken to Soviet weaponry that had been scattered throughout Ukraine, Kazakhstan, and Belarus. The US government encouraged and paid for the removal of all Soviet nuclear weapons based on Ukrainian soil. And a legislative initiative, the Nunn-Lugar Cooperative Threat Reduction Program, has over the last 15 years made enormous progress safeguarding nuclear sites across the former Soviet Union in a bid to ensure their materials don't fall into the hands of terrorists.
The technical assistance which we receive from the United States was important at that time for our national efforts towards improving our nuclear safety.
Nikita Konstantinov is the first vice president of Energoatom, Ukraine's nuclear energy utility. He points to sites like the Kiev Institute for Nuclear Research, which houses one of the country's reactors. Here, Nunn-Lugar funds were spent improving security, installing perimeter fences, training guards, and trying to ensure that the nuclear materials on the site are held under the strictest possible conditions.
Before Soviet time, we practically don't have simulators. And believe me, simulator for nuclear reactor is a big device. And thanks to the United States, now all of our nuclear power plants are equipped with modern simulators provided in the frame of United States assistance.
Back on the traffic-clogged streets of Delhi, there is some confusion about U.S. proliferation policy. The country that worked so hard to get so many Soviet nuclear weapons destroyed is seen by some here as becoming complicit in India's desire to acquire more nuclear bombs. P.R. Chari of the Institute of Peace and Conflict Studies argues the United States is guilty of double standards that will only cause Washington more difficulty.
But the point is that there the United States took the point of view that it wanted to reduce the number of countries which had possession of nuclear weapons. But in the case of India, what one finds is that the United States has no problem with an extension of the number of countries which have nuclear weapons. So there is a certain inconsistency in this.
At the uranium mine in Jadugura, production continues around the clock, and India has plans to open two more uranium mines within the next 5 years. Officials here say whether the US-India nuclear deal goes ahead or not, the domestic nuclear industry will continue to thrive, keeping the lights on all over India, but also building India's nuclear arsenal. For Beyond Fear, I'm Simon Marks in Jadugura, India.
I think it's been a stunning success, but I think we have a long way to go.
That's former U.S. Senator Sam Nunn of Georgia.
It was important that this partnership was created and that it's persisted.
And that's Senator Richard Lugar of Indiana. Nunn Lugar. You often hear their names run together when talk turns to nuclear nonproliferation. That's because when the Soviet Union collapsed, Senator Nunn, a Democrat, found common cause with Senator Lugar, a Republican. They co-sponsored legislation designed to eradicate the threat posed by the old Soviet nuclear biological and chemical weapons stockpiles.
Number one, the Soviet Union was coming apart. Number two, it was a vast arsenal of weapons of mass destruction. And number three, the people who were guarding those weapons of mass destruction and the people who were knowledgeable about how to make them, in many cases, were unemployed.
This was a big project that still goes on, and it's important that there's a partnership between the United States and Russia because the problems of proliferation to other states still is a profound difficulty.
15 years on, the Nunn-Lugar balance sheet is impressive. Nearly 7,000 warheads deactivated, more than 600 intercontinental ballistic missiles destroyed, and nearly 500 missile silos eliminated. But there is still far more to be done. And Sam Nunn is frustrated by the difficulty of keeping the U.S. focused on persistent and very real dangers.
In one storage place in Russia, there are enough chemical weapons to virtually wipe out everybody on the face of the earth. And those are awaiting destruction. That's in a place called Susha. I've been there a couple of times, and it ought to be one of the priorities. But guess what? It's bogged down in bureaucracy. In this case, probably more on the Russian side, but also we have our share in the American side, too. So you would think this would just loom up and it'd be on everybody's front burner, but that's not the case. You have to keep talking about it. You have to keep pressing on it.
These two luminaries in the field of nonproliferation disagree with each other about the proposed U.S. nuclear deal with India. Senator Lugar, a serving member of the Republican caucus on Capitol Hill, is backing his president.
I see no evidence that the Indians are eager for an arms race or are really avidly building more weapons. They would claim that they are in a dangerous neighborhood, that Russia has nuclear weapons. The Chinese have demonstrated nuclear weapons. Their neighbors in Pakistan have at least a fledgling program, maybe more. And they would say to us, you have to understand that that's the predicament that we're in.
Sam Nunn, retired from the U.S. Senate, sees things differently and calls the deal a missed opportunity.
We didn't, in my view, bargain nearly hard enough. I think it was a great opportunity to say to the Indians, okay, let's be partners, but let's do it in a way that's conducive to reducing the dangers of nuclear and catastrophic terrorism. But that wasn't part of the deal.
Lugar takes a more pragmatic view. He argues that collective security is better served by seizing chances that arise, like a strong alliance with an emerging India. And he rejects the notion that the United States projects contradictory policies, often based on fear.
I wouldn't characterize our foreign policy as essentially based on fear. I see it much more one based on opportunity, on all the possible challenges that are out there, but likewise optimism that we will be able to work, sometimes incrementally, more dramatically, through many of these challenges to some significant advances.
This is Beyond Fear, America's Role in an Uncertain World, from the Stanley Foundation and KQED Public Radio.
In France, the city of Caen, like much of Europe almost completely destroyed during the war, is slowly but surely rising again due to Marshall Plan aid. Caen, the center of bitter fighting in the Allied invasion of Normandy, is being helped by ECA funds. Its people have lived in ruins through five harsh winters, but are now moving into the dozens of new buildings which the French have constructed with American help.
We are so often taught that adversity reveals true character, and disasters can be the true test of leadership. If this is so, few recent tests loom larger than the 2004 tsunami in Asia.
Collapsed houses and boats in the middle of houses is what all is there left of Kudlur, as you can see.
The tsunami killed over a quarter of a million people and inundated coastal communities throughout Southeast Asia. In the immediate days after the earthquake and giant waves struck, much of the developed world responded with generosity. But the United States initially came off as almost unconcerned. It wasn't until 3 days after the tsunami that President Bush interrupted his Christmas vacation in Crawford, Texas, to address the disaster publicly.
Laura and I and the American people are shocked, and we are saddened by the terrible loss of life from the recent earthquake and the tsunamis in the Indian Ocean. Our prayers go out to the people who've lost so much to this series of disasters.
He turned to an odd couple, former presidents Bill Clinton and George Bush Sr., to head up the American response to the crisis. They secured over $1 billion in donations for tsunami relief, much of it given to countries like Indonesia, the world's most populous Muslim nation, and a fertile recruiting ground for extremists of the Al-Qaeda variety. Before long, America was sending not only food and tents, but also the U.S. military to lend a helping hand. In the hard-hit area of Aceh, on the northern tip of Indonesia's Sumatra Island, the situation demanded a kind of diplomatic pivot. At the time, the United States had an embargo on most military aid to Indonesia. Now, U.S. leadership in the post-tsunami reconstruction is starting to pay dividends and is even sparking some unforeseen positive results. Correspondent Jocelyn Ford explores the lessons learned.
Johnny Suryawan is a man on a mission. Neatly dressed, the slim 27-year-old with a boyish grin is delivering wood and other supplies to the site of a new outdoor market. It's being built in the small village of Runga Runga with funds from the United States government.
We are 15 combatants working on the market construction.
Runga Runga is a bustling hamlet of 300 families carved from the jungle of Aceh's highlands. Villagers here grow famed Sumatran coffee and hot chili peppers. Runga Runga's lone main street reverberates with the sounds of buses, trucks, and motorcycles making their way up the mountain. But Runga Runga wasn't always this lively. It's one of thousands of communities in Aceh ripped apart by the long civil conflict. It was fought over control of the province's rich oil and gas reserves, human rights abuses, and ethnic identity. Johnny Suryawan says he joined the separatist Free Aceh movement, known locally as GOM, the day the Indonesian military beat him up while he was working on his coffee plantation. He was 20 years old.
The military accused me of being a member of GOM, so I thought, okay, if the military thinks I'm a GOM rebel, it's better if I go join them in the jungle.
The Indonesian military had been fighting with separatist rebels like Johnny for nearly three decades when the devastating wave swept away 170,000 lives here and left a half million homeless. At the time, Aceh was under martial law, and Indonesia did not allow foreigners in the rebellious province, so it was somewhat surprising when less than 2 weeks after the tsunami, United States forces landed in Aceh to assist with recovery.
We need some working parties here, man.
It's a matter of patience and honesty and a genuine desire to help the people here.
Lieutenant Colonel Jay Hatton was one of the first American Marines to go on shore.
We're operating at the basic food shelter level, and that cuts through politics and it cuts through, I think, some of the rhetoric. And once people get on the ground and can start working together, that trust, I think, comes very quickly.
A similar principle worked after the tsunami for the rebels and the Indonesian government. The terrible disaster and the overwhelming need to rebuild helped bring the two parties to the negotiating table. They signed a peace accord in Helsinki just 8 months after the tsunami. 2.5 years later, the crucial issues for Aceh are not just rebuilding, but also how to preserve the peace. The United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, funds a variety of programs. Down on the coast, where the tsunami washed away much of the highway, cars and motorcycles line up to cross this rickety, temporary bridge, wide enough for only one car. This is the start of USAID's showcased tsunami recovery effort, a coastal highway between two important cities in the province. A large sign at the start of the road proudly announces the project.
From the people of the United States, project's route from Banda Aceh to Malabo.
This very significant route for supporting the economic development in that region as well the whole province.
Dr. Kuntoro Mangusubroto heads the Indonesian government's Rehabilitation and Reconstruction Agency in Aceh.
This is something that we appreciate very highly for the USAID helping us here.
But the road project has its critics. The road is far behind schedule because many landowners initially refused to sell their land, arguing the price they were being offered was too low. The delays illustrate that good intentions can be marred by on-the-ground realities. Still, landowners like 22-year-old Muzamil Akbar are eager to see the road built for everyone's benefit and happy to receive some income. He plans to use the money from the land sale to fulfill his dream of becoming a teacher. And despite the problems with the road project, it seems to be having the intended effect in this devoutly Muslim province on attitudes about America.
USA, America. America, good.
Back in Rungarunga, former rebel Johnny says he's happy to return to civilian life. He's also pleased with the new covered market. The market construction was part of a post-conflict program funded by the U.S. government and implemented by the intergovernmental group, the International Organization for Migration. Communities like Rungarunga received grants of $15,000 and were then given the opportunity in an open meeting to decide what to do with it. The idea is to get neighbors who may have been fearful of each other during the conflict to work together for the good of the entire community. The program also requires a portion of the jobs go to former rebels. Marion Carney is media officer for the International Organization for Migration's post-conflict program.
You don't want them to pick up the guns again. The danger is that if you don't give them some kind of livelihood assistance, as we are doing, that they will then continue to look for funds in the way that they did in the past, which was using a gun.
Johnny has made his last delivery of wood to the market project and is working out what he and his men can do next to earn a living.
It's all the chili plantation, chili farm.
He and a couple of his former fighters have plowed the $550 in profits back into their farms. In the meantime, Johnny and some of his former fighters have turned to illegal logging and are talking about other illegal activities.
My friends and I often discuss what should we do if we have no jobs and nobody supports us. One of my friends suggests we start robbing.
To prevent people like Johnny from turning to crime and to help tsunami victims, USAID and other aid organizations are also investing in long-term projects to rebuild the economy. In the provincial capital of Banda Aceh, an American aid group has donated a two-story fish market to replace one that was washed away. And USAID has hired consultants to comb the province in search of products like tropical fish, exotic spices, and fresh produce farmers might export to global markets. Aid workers say the key to helping tsunami survivors and to nurturing peace is the same: build a more prosperous society. For Beyond Fear, I'm Jocelyn Ford, Banda Aceh, Indonesia.
When the tsunami hit out in Asia, I was there within a week or so, and we started sending money to the area.
Former Secretary of State and retired General Colin Powell well understands the power of U.S. leadership in both war and peace.
I think the negative views that have been expressed in recent years are a function of the Iraq War and, frankly, continuing anxiety about the situation between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And I think if those two problems could be resolved, then I think you would start to see those numbers go back up in the other direction. But are we going through a bad spot right now with respect to how people generally in the world view the United States? Yes. Is it recoverable? Sure, it's recoverable.
It's often argued that leadership is about winning respect first, and then people want to essentially follow you up the hill. I mean, do you agree with that idea, and can we apply this better to our relationship with the rest of the world?
I think leadership is about trust, and you garner trust by convincing people in the rightness of your cause, and also by sometimes taking chances. You can't always wait until everybody agrees with the action you're about to take. Sometimes you have to act and then hope that public opinion will follow. We have been engaged in multilateral negotiations and diplomacy with our European friends to do something about the Iranian nuclear program. We have been in multilateral discussions with our friends in Asia to do something about the North Korean program. HIV/AIDS, solving the North-South crisis in Sudan, dealing with the problems of Liberia, of Haiti, so many other places. We have worked with our friends.
You pointed these examples where America is working with our coalition partners, talking, listening. But could we do an even better job? Do we have the ratio off slightly in terms of engaging versus essentially asserting our authority?
I think we could do a better job. I think we could take more time to listen and consider the views of others, and not just hear them, but actually listen to them and crank their positions into our own deliberations as we go forward. I've always been a believer in diplomacy, a believer in dialogue. Let's do everything we can to avoid a crisis or to avoid a war.
Look, I know hope springs eternal, but many people worry that we're past the point of no return on America's ability to lead the world.
Well, you know, that's nonsense. We have many friends in the world. We have great alliances. We have the NATO alliance. We have a good relationship with the European Union. We have a strategic relationship with India, with China. We ended the Asian Cold War, brought down the bamboo curtain, and now we have an extremely strong open trading relationship with China.
Well, without inviting you to take pot shots at present policy, that's not my intention. Are there lessons to be drawn from our experience in Iraq when we think about America's leadership role moving forward?
When you have to undertake an operation like this, make sure that you have planned well for all potential consequences. It wasn't the first phase of this operation that gave us difficulty. The regime came down quickly. I'm glad they're all gone. We did not plan sufficiently for the aftermath and did not understand the nature of the environment. And then when the insurgency broke out, we didn't respond sufficiently to that.
Many Americans do seem to see the wider world through what's really a prism of fear. A lot of international threats are all too real, given what we've seen, and we have to fiercely guard against them. But to what extent do you worry that reacting to fear is almost the defining idea of our foreign policy?
It's not good. You're often saying many Americans see, or everybody in the world sees. And I would submit to you that many Americans see an entirely different picture than the picture you just conveyed to me. I travel widely around America, and I see people who are working hard, who are confident about the future, and they have put terrorism into its context. It is a danger to us. We have to guard against it. We have to go after the terrorists. But at the same time, we can't let terrorists change the way we live.
What is the right blend of military power versus other kinds of engagement if the goal is making the world a safer place?
You can't compete them that way. There's always a suggestion, you know, we should take more money from the Defense Department and give it to the State Department or give it to Social Security or give it to the Agricultural Department. We're a rich nation and we can afford whatever we need if we're willing to pay for it.
Well, Colin Powell, thank you very much for this.
Okay.
Go up South Orange Avenue, Walnut Street, River Road, then a place called Nike Drive in East Hanover, New Jersey.
Turn left, then you have reached your destination.
Hi, I'm now standing on a suburban New Jersey hilltop, once the site of a Nike missile silo built more than a half century ago. The Pentagon called it NY-80, part of a ring of missiles set up to defend New York City from long-range Soviet bombers. While the guidance system for a Nike Hercules rocket required fancy technology for its time, the basic strategy to ensure the security of the metropolis was straightforward: launch the missile, destroy the foe. How things have changed. Back then, the fear was specific: Soviets armed with nukes. Now, we still fear for our safety, but the threats come at us from a confounding number of directions. In fact, just 20 miles that away once stood the twin towers of the World Trade Center. It will be tough to find an adult American alive who hasn't reflected on the best way to make these fears go away. Military force is one response, but there are plenty of other ways to engage, as we've heard over the course of this hour. We've looked at several concrete examples of America partnering with the world to help people in other countries feel more secure, with the added benefit of increasing our own security here. Hearing these reports, we get a sense of the stakes should America's ability or determination to take a leadership role in world affairs erode. What any regular listener to the news knows all too well, there is no shortage of places where some American goodwill, investment, elbow grease, or in some cases firepower might go a long way to help people around the world have better lives. Let the United Nations, the European Union, even China shoulder some of this, and there will still be plenty of global engagement left over for the United States. Of course, it's tempting to add the phrase, if we had the money to do it. But former Secretary of State Colin Powell said something startling in this regard. You heard him. He said, "We're a rich nation. We can afford whatever we need if we're willing to pay for it." Take a look at the budgets of all the branches of government that pay for our relations with the rest of the world, and there is some terribly serious money to play with. More money than the entire government budgets of some large industrialized countries, if you include the cost of our military. How can it not be an issue of allocation? How we choose to move the chips around the board? I'm standing on the grave of the Nike missile system, which was dismantled in the 1970s. These days, our big defensive missile research is more ambitious. The Star Wars program, people like to call it. Its price tag last year was about $8 billion, a figure that happens to be close to the budget for the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, which runs about $9 billion. This is not some argument against missile defense. It's an invitation to reflect on the idea that we are quite prone to investing in hardware, but sometimes have a tougher time grasping the return on investment we get by investing in goodwill. There is a risk in each. It's not clear the Star Wars system can be made to work effectively. It's not clear what you might label as soft power exercised abroad will stop every incoming terrorist attack either. What is clear is that our investment decisions as voters with ultimate control of our government's foreign relations budget should be guided more by information and less by fear. For Beyond Fear, America's Role in an Uncertain World, I'm David Brancaccio.
Beyond Fear, America's Role in an Uncertain World, from the Stanley Foundation and KQED Public Radio, was produced by Simon Marks, Kristen McHugh, and Keith Porter. The sound engineer is Rima Snyder of Red Wagon Audio. For more information about Beyond Fear or to share your thoughts about the program, visit us online at stanleyfoundation.org. Special thanks to Jocelyn Ford, Sharif Hamdi, Ken Mills, Rachel Silverman-Locke, Sapna Bhartiya, Larissa Nomenko, Dennis Levkovich, Anya Ardayeva, Lou Olkowski, Jesse Lang, Larry Josephson, Robert Ald, and the Radio Foundation, Air Force Captain Tony Wickman and the Public Affairs Unit of the Combined Joint Task Force Horn of Africa, and the staff of Feature Story News. Beyond Fear, America's Role in an Uncertain World, is a production of the Stanley Foundation and KQED Public Radio. On the web at kqed.org and stanleyfoundation.org.